Good afternoon and welcome to Spokane Public Radio's Northwest Arts Review, a half hour exploring the people, places, and events forming the rich arts tapestry we enjoy here in the Inland Northwest and our wider Intermountain Northwest region. I'm Jim Tevenin, pleased to be your guide on this journey. Today, Chris Massini welcomes Spokane Poet Laureate Chris Cook, who has been busy making COVID-related alterations in the way poetry is offered and received hereabouts. Eastern Washington University piano professor Jody Graves offers some memories of her early years learning her instrument. Dan Webster reviews a new film musical available through streaming. And Spokane Symphony Orchestra music director James Lowe reminds us of an upcoming virtual performance. Music today is from the Spokane Symphony and from pianist Jody Graves. This is Northwest Arts Review.
Chris Cook, thanks for joining me. And why don't you give us a quick update, sort of for those who aren't familiar, what is the Poet Laureate position in Spokane and how has it changed in this year where everything has changed?
Well, it's kind of the public face of poetry in this town. And it's a kind of a servant's job. I mean, I'm happy to take center stage and take deep bows, but it's really more about offering opportunities for writers in the region to come together. And you're right, it has changed. I'm happy to report that the poetry open mics that I've been associated with hosting, three-minute mic every first Friday at Auntie's and broken mic every Wednesday, which was at Neato Burrito, they continue via Zoom. We've not missed a beat. And the nice thing about that, I would say, is that we can have poets joining us from all over the planet. We're not just limited to those who can drive to a burrito shop on a Wednesday night or a bookstore on a Friday night. And we can all be unmasked, you know, if we are in the privacy of our own homes. It's kind of nice to see smiling faces. And so that is the mixed blessing about poetry during the age of COVID.
And last time we talked, you said that you'd been ruminating on this idea of a poetry project themed around the neighborhoods of Spokane, and that has launched officially now. So tell us about that project.
It has, yeah. Well, I love this city. I've been here a long time. I've lived in, by my count, 12 different homes in 10 different Spokane neighborhoods. And I wanted to create a project about this city's identity through its neighborhoods. It seems to me that great cities are well known for having unique neighborhoods, the characters, the sights, sounds, and the smells. And even though the people change over the years, the neighborhood's identity remains. And it can run the gamut from Mr. Rogers' vision of a neighborhood to the one described in the Tom Waits song that gave me this project's name. You know, there's love in both extremes. It's just expressed differently. And so there are neighbors that you adore and ones that drive you crazy, yet you find a way to coexist. And so I enjoy the thought that if enough neighborhoods are represented in this project, this anthology would form my hometown through poetry.
So the idea is to collect poems from neighborhoods all over the city. And then how are they going to be published?
They'll be published virtually online via SpokaneArts.org. At a later date, we may take a best of submissions and turn it into a printed anthology. But it is open to all ages and all styles of poetry.
So kids, adults, elders, anyone who wants to submit can submit a poem about their neighborhood or somebody else's neighborhood, I suppose.
Exactly. And yeah, we've tried to open it up to former residents of Spokane as well, who might have fond memories of their neighborhood. And actually, you know, it was probably 20 years ago that I was really struck by Tom I. Davis's poems about Peaceful Valley, the late great Spokane poet. And more recently, I've enjoyed former Spokane Poet Laureate Tom Carraway's West Central poems. Dennis Held has done some about his home in Vinegar Flats. That's one of my former neighborhoods. And my current neighborhood, Brown's Addition, has been immortalized by Anthony Brighton over the years. So I also like that in the best sense, these poets could all be characters in a Tom Waits song. They're all kind of lovable rogues. I also thought of Laura Reed, our other former Spokane Poet Laureate, because she's written a poem about Donut Parade that I just love, but I would never call her a rogue.
Well, it takes all kinds of voices to capture a city like Spokane. So folks are wondering, sort of how to get started. Do you have an example of a neighborhood poem you can share with us?
Sure, I'd love to. I wrote this as a tribute to a young lady that I would see occasionally in my old neighborhood on the Upper South Hill. I'd catch her usually walking on South Regal. It's called Vibrations. She is always alone. I see her several times a week, though she has never seen me. Her progress along the sidewalk on South Regal is straight, despite having never used her white cane like the others, who waggle and tap from side to side. Instead, she scoots it in front of her like a turntable stylist locked into the groove of a vinyl record, picking up the vibrations of the earth. I wonder which album the world has selected for her today and whether she likes the music. I decide that she does because whenever I see her, she's smiling. She never wears dark glasses either. I'm grateful for that because I can see that her lovely eyes are always directed slightly to the side and heavenward. I feel a pang of guilt for watching her. I was taught that staring is impolite, but I perversely wonder if it's still rude if the person you're staring at will never know. Of course it's still rude. What the hell's wrong with me for even thinking something like that? Today, her path to the Albertsons on 57th is safe despite all the snow. The neighbors have kept the sidewalks clear. It's bitter cold, yet she's wearing a flimsy windbreaker. Something tells me it's intentional, that her other senses are so keen that she enjoys feeling temperatures in a way that I cannot fathom. With her bloodhound-like sense of smell, does she like picking up the scent of those who've passed this way? Does she enjoy the buzz rush of unspeakably spicy food? Does she go to outdoor concerts and cozy up to the speaker tower to get sent to oblivion? Can she experience love more deeply than others? And has anyone loved her? While she was in the store, the unthinkable has happened. A plow has passed by and covered her path home with a tidal wave of brown rime. The earth's surface has opened up. The underworld has disgorged its evil bile for her to try to navigate. The apocalypse has come. Ultimately, she discovers that the only way to walk home is on the shoulder of the busy street that's been narrowed by all the snow against the flow of traffic. Ironically, it's foggy and dark, so all the drivers have been partially blinded. The cars are going too fast for the ice underfoot. They have no choice but to pass dangerously close to her. I know all of this because I, too, am in the line of cars driving towards her. As I approach, I issue a silent prayer and an apology as my passenger side mirror passes within inches of her. In that instant, I see that she's still looking slightly to the side and heavenward, and that for the love of sweet screaming Jesus, she is still smiling. A little while later, I wonder if maybe I love her.
That was Chris Cook reading one of his poems, capturing his impressions of the South Hill neighborhood of Spokane. His new project is called In the Neighborhood, soliciting poems from all over, neighborhoods all over Spokane. And so if folks are interested, how can they submit their poems, Chris?
Yes, go online to SpokaneArts.org, and you'll find the portal there and all the instructions you need. And entries are open until February 12th.
Fantastic. Well, Chris, thanks so much for joining us, and look forward to talking to you when these poems are published and hearing some of them.
Thanks so much, Chris.
Dr. Jody Graves, outstanding solo and collaborative pianist, cultural ambassador, and a 2019 inductee into the Steinway Piano Teacher Hall of Fame, a musician who we are proud to claim as an Inland Northwest treasure. She is the guest of honor on next Monday's Music That Matters at 7 here on KPBX. Our conversation on that program ranges widely, but begins in a place that I love to start, a musician's earliest memories of finding their instrument. Here's a bit of that, prefaced by Jody Graves playing the music of Carlos Guastavino. When did you first play?
When did I first start?
Yeah.
It's always the question. It's a fun question, too, because for me, I was actually three. And that's because mother was a pianist, and she was always playing on this. We had an upright Wurlitzer that was a player piano, so it had the little doors and the little levers for the piano rolls. And that's the piano I started on. And I heard mom playing, and I would climb up and try to sound out what she was doing. You know, everything from Chopin's E major etude to Alley Cat. And you know, the fun tunes that you did when people came over for a party or something like that. And so I learned with her a little bit, and then I went to a teacher when I was... six. So.
Okay. Yeah. Right. So, been at it a good long time. It was, you grew up with the piano around and really in your blood. Mm-hmm. Do you recall some of the earliest pieces you played that you really said, oh boy, I have to play that?
The first one that comes to mind is there was a swan song in John Thompson's Book One. It's a red book that is now under glass at the Smithsonian, so that tells you.
Know it well.
Yes. And it was so pretty, and it had all those pretty little arpeggios in the left hand. And when you put the pedal down and you could make that sound, I was just enamored with that, and I couldn't get enough. I mean, even before I could actually reach the pedals, I would stand up like a lot of little kids do, so I could make that happen because that sound to me was glorious. So that was my first.
Do you recall the, and it may be more than one piece, but the first, I'm doing air quotes here, the first grown-up piece.
Oh, the first grown-up piece. I would probably say... Well, those I'm thinking more of like the intermediate repertoire, but it felt like a grown-up piece at the time, which was the Mendelssohn Venetian Boat Songs, and being able to play my first Mozart. Yeah. And I just loved it because I was, when I was 17, I went to the orchestra director at the high school and I said, I want to play the Mozart D minor piano concerto. And he said, well, do you know it? And I said, no, I'm going to learn it. And it was really precocious, but he agreed. And so I learned the whole thing. I mean, mm-hmm. in those days, you know, sometimes you would just do a movement, but I did the entire concerto, played in Music Fest with it and had some fun with that. But I was also reading about how Mozart would improvise cadenzas. So I thought, well, I'm going to do that, which is exactly what I did. Now, mind you, at that age, I was not necessarily completely within the style, but I did improvise both cadenzas in both first and last movements.
Well, you know, that's become a thing where you write a cadenza for a Mozart's or a Beethoven concerto, yeah. and it takes on a little modern idiom every now and again.
It does. So yeah, it does.
You are just ahead of your time as far as that
right.
went with that.
Right.
Teachers who were especially influential on your life as a young pianist?
Mm-hmm. I worked with it was a challenge when I was pre-college because I spent part of my teenage years in foster care and didn't always have a teacher, but I listened a lot and practiced anywhere I could. And when I went to college, I came here to Spokane, studied with David Roskowski at Eastern, and I studied with Margie May Ott at Whitworth. And she was my first major influential teacher. I worked with her for almost 10 years.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Here's a bit of Alexander Scriabin's music, played by Jody Graves. You can hear more of her story and playing Monday at 7 on Music That Matters here on KPBX. Dan Webster thinks that Ryan Murphy's film adaptation of the stage musical The Prom is cliched and cloying, but in his review says it offers at least a bit of entertainment.
If you look at the American Film Institute's list of the greatest musicals, you'll see a wide variety of themes and styles. Some of the films in the top 10 don't even seem like musicals at all. Sure, there is music, unforgettable music, in The Wizard of Oz, number 3 on AFI's list. But I've never considered it the same as The Sound of Music, number 4, West Side Story, number 2, or Singing in the Rain, number 1. Music isn't the first thing that comes to mind when I think of Dorothy and Toto's trek to the Emerald City. No, when I think of The Wizard of Oz, I think of melting witches, flying monkeys, a tin man with a heart, a scarecrow with a brain, and a lion with courage, not to mention a man standing behind a curtain who was able to fool so many into thinking that he's the one still in charge, all comparisons to current events, of course, being merely coincidental. Something that is far closer to what I consider a standard movie musical is The Prom, Ryan Murphy's adaptation of the Broadway musical of the same name. Starring Meryl Streep, James Corden, Nicole Kidman, and featuring a talented newcomer, Joellen Pellman, The Prom is based, very loosely, on a true story. It was in 2010 that a Mississippi high school student named Constance McMillan was barred from attending her senior prom as she wanted, wearing a tuxedo with her girlfriend at her side. The local school board said she couldn't. She objected. One thing led to another, and the board canceled prom. Ultimately, with the support of celebrities such as former NSYNC boy band member Lance Bass, McMillan was able to attend an alternate, quote-unquote, inclusive prom organized by a group called the Mississippi Safe Schools Coalition. Murphy's adaptation, which reportedly is nearly identical to the stage musical, follows a similar storyline. Only it begins with the celebrities, mainly Dee Dee Allen, played by Streep, and Barry Glickman, played by Corden, who are rebounding from ruinous reviews of their latest show, a dimwittedly conceived musical biopic based on the life of Eleanor Roosevelt. Along with Angie Dickinson, played by Kidman, and the frustrated actor-bartender Trent Oliver, played by Andrew Rannells, Dee Dee and Barry, intent on recharging their reputations by doing something civic-minded, end up heading to the small Indiana town where senior Emma Nolan, played by Pellman, has been told that, like the real-life student McMillan, she can't attend prom with her girlfriend. During a tempestuous PTA meeting that, with the encouragement of her supportive school principal, Tom Hawkins, played by Keegan-Michael Key, Emma attempts to convince the board to change its decision. And of course, it's at this very moment that the self-absorbed celebs burst into the meeting hall with Trent proclaiming, "We are liberals from Broadway," and Barry adding, "We are here from New York City and we are going to save you," which, surprise, surprise, doesn't go over well, or more correctly, at all. Remember, though, this is musical comedy. So despite the fact that Emma gets punked into attending the wrong prom event, that Dee Dee alienates her most ardent fan, Principal Tom, that Barry refuses to make up with the mother who he feels betrayed him, and even that the head of the school's PTA, played by Kerry Washington, considers being gay something to be avoided at all costs, despite all this, you know from the opening musical number that things will work out for everyone. Which, in itself, isn't bad, except that it all seems so simplistic. The script by the same writers of the stage production, Bob Martin and Chad Begelin, would have us believe that despite all evidence to the contrary, all we have to do to bring a discordant America together is just force each side to listen to one another. Oh, plus reminding the self-righteous of what the good book says. As Trent, while performing in a shopping mall courtyard, sings, "There's one rule that trumps them all. Love thy neighbor, love thy neighbor, love thy neighbor trumps them all." And Reynolds sings and dances it well, as do all the performers, actually, even if director Murphy, one of the creators of the TV show Glee, does get a bit too busy with his camera, which makes the choreography at times feel more frenzied than a Costco shopping trip on Black Friday. But does that really matter? The Prom is just bouncy enough in theme and execution that only the most discerning of musical fans will likely care. From this side of the Emerald City Curtain, it seems that, especially during this time of pandemic, a bit of fantasy can't be mad, no matter how cloying it might be. For Spokane Public Radio, I'm Dan Webster.
Movies 101 host Dan Webster writes about movies and more for Spokane7.com. We talked with Spokane Symphony Orchestra music director James Lowe earlier this month. As a reminder that orchestral music is still alive in Spokane, albeit in a thoroughly COVID-transformed way, here's a reprise of just a bit of our conversation. And for context, this New Year's Eve was the day on which James Lowe was to lead his first performance of the Beethoven Ninth Symphony with the orchestra.
I'm particularly saddened, of course, because this was going to be my first Beethoven 9 New Year's performance, but there we are. It got cancelled, and it's Beethoven's 250th birthday year. So to end this year with that piece would have been absolutely appropriate, and it was something I was very much looking forward to, but there we are. But instead, we're having an online evening. We're calling it kind of Spokane Symphony and Friends, We have the fantastic Spokane author, of course, Jess Walter, is coming to give us like a New Year's address. I'm thinking of it's a little bit like the Queen's speeches here on Christmas Day, but for in Spokane flavor. And we have Cammie Bradley, who of course is a wonderful locally based singer who was on America's Got Talent, hugely successful there. And of course, our own musicians. We have a little string orchestra that we can get safely, socially distanced on stage, which will be led by Mateusz Wolski. And it's going to be a program of light classical music and some of Cammie's songs and a couple of the usual things that you would expect to find in a New Year's Eve concert. So it'll be a nice celebration. The program's about an hour. Tickets are available from our website, and suggested donation is $20. If you can't afford that, if you've been impacted by COVID, you can't afford that, then there's a special code. If you can afford more, of course, we're always happy for extra donations. But that's the idea. And I think it's going to air at 4 o'clock in the afternoon on the 31st. If you buy a ticket, you can watch it through well into June. So it's very good value for money, and it's going to be a very fun program.
Let me ask the technical question. So there are now there's been the gala, a very successful virtual performance, and now coming up the New Year's concert, undoubtedly that will be just a wonderful virtual experience. In terms of putting this together and working with musicians, what has evolved as your way of doing that, just in terms of who is where and who does what?
That's a very interesting question. So in terms of the actual performance, we are pre-recording this week, in fact. One of the main reasons for that is to live stream symphony orchestras. If you can imagine, it's a little bit like putting Formula One or you know the football on TV. It's a very fast-moving, very difficult thing to do. So it's actually much easier to pre-record for us at this stage. So we're recording it this week. And it's been a kind of effort from loads of people. I mean, we've all kind of been working day and night in the last few weeks on getting this together. It's a local production company. Don Hamilton is producing it for us. It's been hugely fun. As we say, you know, it's very strange to suddenly turn into a TV production studio from being an orchestral this time. To pivot that quickly has been quite tricky.
Details on the virtual Spokane Symphony Orchestra New Year's program are at spokanesymphony.org. Thanks for listening to Northwest Arts Review. I'm Jim Tevenin. Help today came from Chris Messini. We're grateful as well for the contributions of Dr. Jody Graves, Chris Cook, Dan Webster, and James Lowe. We'll go out with a bit more Brahms from the Spokane Symphony Orchestra, a reminder of the glory of orchestra sound. Let's hope we hear it again soon. Happy New Year. Join us again next week for another Northwest Arts Review.